thanks for your attention. I know it's hard to break up those conversations, but we got a lot to hear. So, as I mentioned, we've got a special guest today, part of a newer part of our City Club family, who's seen all these programs. And by the way, I think that was Etsy Scott in the back. Hi, you're here. Welcome. I had a spot at the head table for you, but I couldn't tell if you were here. So always great to have Z Scott join us. Thank you. So Caleb Brookman's been working with us, and he's been watching all the programs very intently. And it's really neat to get, as we start to get the next generation more involved in City Club and reimagine it, it's really neat to get his perspective on things, because this is exactly who we want and who I believe is the future of this club. So Caleb had a couple thoughts after he saw what we were going to do today, and he just shared them with me, and I asked him if he'd come up and, like I mentioned earlier, introduce the program. So if you will please join me in welcoming, and he hasn't done this before, so let's do a little extra welcome to Caleb Brookman.
Thank you, Dan. As Dan introduced me, hello, I am Caleb Brookman, and I've been a part of City Club since this January. And as he said, you know, I had a lot of thoughts in terms of what this program meant to me and why it is very imperative that we shed a light on black men in Chicago and why we need to stand up and lead as we did before and we can do again. And one of the biggest things, I think, is family dynamic. You know, I grew up with a father, and I understand that, you know, having a father means to have a leader, have a divine role model that you can, you know, model yourself after. And when there's no father in the home, what do these men look to? What do we as, you know, growing men look to if there's no foundation that has set that for us, you know? And so I think as far as role models go, my dad being in my life, you know, it really changed me and it really allowed me to see how I needed to step out into society as a black man. And for my future fathers that are in here, I'm not a father yet, but, you know, for my future fathers that are in here, you know, it is important for us to be able to understand the dynamics that we have to navigate within this system. And as I speak of this system, we well know and we are all well acquainted as black men to the fact that the system in and of itself has not really been kind to us in terms of how sorry, y'all, give me a second. Takes a minute. You know, when I look into the history of, you know, this country and what it means for me to be able to be a role model and also to be able to lead the next generations, I think of it as something that, you know, we take on with pride, you know, no matter what. And I feel as if, you know, there is change in the air and that there is change coming, and that change is me. And it's all of you. And when I think about this topic and it in and of itself, I think to myself, okay, even if we are able to get back to an economic, you know, stability, what good is it if we don't have knowledge of what we've done before and how we can rebuild it as far as, you know, the black family dynamic goes in terms of what we did in Tulsa. If we don't learn of our history and if we don't know who we are from before, how can we even know where we're going next? You know, we'll just repeat the steps of yesterday. And, you know, I am an active, very active participant in not allowing that to happen. So I speak. Thank you. And so I speak to the panelists that are going to be here today, and I thank you guys so much for being able to, you know, bring this about for not just me, but for everybody that's, you know, coming after me in terms of my own generations and also the people beside me as well. And so I speak to that and say a restructuring of our communities is heavily needed. And I'm glad that you're all here today to really speak on why that is needed and what we can do and how we can still navigate the system in and of itself to bring about better humanity, period. Because it's bigger than just black and white. It's bigger than just whatever demographic that you think, you know, that you come from. It's a unity. We need to be unionized and come together as a people to recognize that our footsteps in this country is its own origin point. And what I mean by that is, without us, what is America, truly? Really think about it. Without us, what is America, truly? And I don't speak to just black men. I speak to my women as well, you know, and what we've done and what we've built. And we must make sure and remember that this is us. You know, it's bigger than just what we see in the system, bigger than just how we view ourselves in it. It is us. And until we are at the foothold, until we are at the position of leadership, we ain't going nowhere. And, you know, the more I work at City Club, the more I see the many partners that, you know, collaborate with us to create the programs that we all enjoy. And the one for today is in collaboration with the Phil Foundation. Can we get another round of applause to the Phil Foundation? Now, the Phil Foundation came to us with this topic that seemingly gets swept under the rug despite the dire and glaring situation that needs to be addressed in Chicago that we all see. So, of course, when they came to Dan, he was like, absolutely, let's launch this, you know. So we want to be, as far as City Club goes, we're an organization, as Dan also put it, that just brings people together to be able to be in the room together and talk about things that really are important to Chicago. And so we wanted to also be a people who create positive impact, especially after the pandemic, as we all know, you know, and the many struggles that it, you know, brought to America and all around the world in and of itself. And so it's my honor to introduce to you one of those people who've been doing just that. Ladies and gentlemen, I welcome our moderator for today, President of Field Foundation, Daniel Ash.
I'm going to ask that all the panelists just join me now so we can just be really efficient in time. So just come forward. So first of all, let me once again thank Dan and Caleb for that wonderful introduction. I couldn't think of a better way to start today's event than to have that testimony from Caleb. I really appreciate it. I'm going to just offer a few introductory remarks before we get to the discussion. And I'm going to do something that I know my communications director, Maria, is probably going to freak out because I'm going to go off script straight away. So when we were all gathering, a couple of people came up to me and asked a very legitimate question. The question was, can we talk about this openly, given what's going on in our country? And I was a bit surprised, even though I worry about what's going on in our country. But as I thought about it, my response was very simple. Absolutely, we're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about race. We're going to talk about black people, black men, black fathers. We're going to talk about systemic racism. We're going to do it honestly. We're going to do it passionately. And at the end of the day, we want this conversation to lead to individual and collective action. So we're not going to let the climate of the moment diminish our commitment to the work. And quite frankly, we're not going to allow this moment to make us less courageous. So I have to say this. A number of you in this room knew me when I was much younger, no gray hair. And I was starting my career in what we now call the social impact space. I had the good fortune to work for an initiative called Strengthening Fragile Families. It was funded by the Ford Foundation. And the entire idea of this initiative, which was led and directed by primarily black men in the city, was to examine how we can engage black fathers in the lives of their children who were receiving public benefits. It was a demonstration project. For those who work in philanthropy, we know what those are. That's when you spend money to learn. You test a thesis. And the thesis is very simple. Like, can we actually create the conditions where these kids are better off because they're connected to their fathers? Now, some of you might say, well, of course. A child connected to their father, of course, is going to make that child better off.
Yes, sir.
But when it came to poor black men in this city, and we tested this initiative in Baltimore and Los Angeles, we were surprised. We weren't. The folks weren't in the program. But investors, public policymakers were surprised that the presence of a father could have such an indelible impact on the outcomes of a child. I come to this work because, like Caleb, a black man, a black father saved my life. My father chose to raise a foster kid. He chose to eventually adopt that kid. Me. And it's because of his guidance, his love, his commitment to me that I'm here today. So I share that because this work is both professional and personal for me. I share it because this is, again, a full circle moment. In 1998, I wrote a report called Face to Face with Fathers. 1998, I actually found the copy of it. And everything that was reported then is reported in this report that we're releasing today, albeit it's much better written. Again, I highlight that point because I don't want my successor to be on this stage 20 years from now having the same conversation. I want us as a city to make a commitment to centering men, specifically black men, when we talk about social justice in this city. It doesn't mean that we decenter anyone else. But it means that we have to be really intentional about including this population. The second point I want to make, for those of you who know the Field Foundation, you know we're deeply committed to creating the conditions for power building on Chicago's South and West Side. It's our belief that residents, black and brown folks, accessing their own individual innate power and their collective power as residents connecting with one another, it is that power that's going to lead the transformation we need to see in our city. To do that well, men, black men, brown men, have to be part of that calculus. In addition to power building, it's important that we create space for individual and collective healing. When you read this report, you're going to see, particularly in the front of the book, a really deep and profound discussion about the impact of systemic racism. It's deep, it's emotional, it's personal, it's physical, it's traumatic. We have to heal individually and collectively. And it's that healing that creates the conditions for power building to really take hold and drive agendas forward. Last point I want to make before inviting my panel into this conversation. This moment is about action. Something that we are saying now more often at the Field Foundation, we're not committed to just helping people organize. It's nice. It's good to have community meetings. It's good to see residents connect with one another. But our commitment is going deeper. When residents connect with one another and they commit to creating an agenda, it's our responsibility at the Field Foundation to drive that agenda forward in partnership with the community. This conversation is part of that mindset, that intentionality. We fully anticipate being in arms, in lockstep, with folks like Richard, folks like Dr. Boy, driving this agenda forward. So this is about, again, not just reading a report and sitting it aside and saying that was nice. It's about acting on the report. And we're going to get to some of the things that you can do in a little bit. I want to, before we go to the panel, Maria, I didn't forget, I want to make sure we thank a few people in this room, because without them and their institutions, this report wouldn't be possible. First of all, the Christopher Family Foundation. Are you guys here? Thank you. We have the Polk Brothers Foundation. The Chicago Workforce Funders Alliance. I have a feeling I'm forgetting someone, and I want to make sure I don't do that. I think that's it. Fry Foundation. Thank you, Matt. Woo! Y'all saw me sweating up here. I was like, okay, who is it? Who is this in here somewhere? Thank you. Without committed individuals working in these institutions, this work is not possible. So that thank you is very sincere. We really appreciate it. Now, I'm going to join the table, and we're going to open up this conversation. So we're going to begin with each of you introducing yourself, and I want you to begin with what brings you to this table, this work. So it's not just the bio, we don't need that, but I really want to hear from you all, like, how do you arrive at this work? Let's begin, Richard, with you, and then we'll work our way through.
That's cool.
All right, how y'all doing? My name is Richard Wallace. I'm the founding executive director of an organization called Equity and Transformation, also known as EAT. I am the son. You can give it a hand for EAT, Equity and Transformation. Yeah. I'm the son of Reverend Green and Eugene Wallace, and my stepfather, Michael Smith. And I'm a grandson to Alma Wallace, Woodrow Wallace, who came from Jackson, Mississippi. Hey. And got some Jackson folks in here. And Columbus Taylor and Allie Johnson, who came from Arkansas. Shout out to Arkansas. Arkansas in the building. Jackson be like, yeah, Arkansas. But, and so my mother and my family has been in service to the people for a very long time. So she raised me in service. And that's how I arrived in the work. She used to take me to penitentiaries all across the state. She was a minister, and she was denied entry into the church at the time because she was a woman. And so she chose to minister behind the prison walls. And she would take me from place to place and place to place to place to place, and she'd be speaking. And there's pictures of me speaking. They thought I was going to be a preacher of some sort. I think this is still ministry work in very real ways, right? It says I'm on the ground. But we founded Equity and Transformation in 2018, and I came from labor. I'd done a lot of work in labor and workforce development, organizing in the temp labor sector, early in the morning, watching our brothers and sisters line up at 5 a.m. If you haven't traveled down Roosevelt or Cermak, going towards Berwyn, you'll see these staffing agencies, and our people are thirsty for labor, and they're being denied access to employment. At high rates, right? And I was curious about, okay, well, what do our people do once we are denied? We don't just stop, you know, at the point of denial. Like, our people hustle and make ends meet. So we founded Equity and Transformation to really bring that voice into democracy, right? Like, the folks who are boxed out, excluded from formal labor opportunities, folks like Eric Garner, who was killed selling loose cigarettes, folks like Alton Sterling, right? Killed in New Orleans selling DVDs. Those folks matter, and their voices matter. And they're also very innovative and resilient people. And so we began, we built Equity and Transformation in 2018 to really bring those voices deeper into our democracy. So that's how I arrived in the work.
Dion.
How you doing? Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Dion Hodrick. I'm a member of Equity and Transformation. I'm like a byproduct of Richard Wallace and Lonzo Waheed. I was introduced to this work through the Guaranteed Income Program. Basically, I was a recipient of the Guaranteed Income Program where I received $500 a month for 12 months. And through that, I was introduced to Equity and Transformation. And I learned a lot dealing with Equity and Transformation as far as my mental health, you know what I'm saying, my physical wellness. Just a whole well-rounded experience, you know what I'm saying, besides the money that they offered. It offered a lot of opportunities to deal with people that I wouldn't normally sit in rooms with and have conversations about things I wouldn't normally talk to regular folks about. So basically, I'm just a byproduct of this guy, and he's showing me the ropes about building with my community and being a leader and making great decisions.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Dr. Clinton Boyd, Jr., Executive Director of Fathers, Families, and Healthy Communities. And for me, I come to this work from a variety of angles. One, I'm a Chicago native, you know, born and raised on the west side of Chicago, byproduct of the Austin community, North Lawndale, and West Garfield communities. I claim them all. But I'm also a descendant of the Great Migration, because my parents made that trek during the second wave of the Great Migration up here to Chicago. My mother coming from Osceola, Arkansas. My father coming from the Delta, Webb, Tutwiler, Mississippi. And so I definitely have some southern roots that run deep through my bones. But while I may come through my parents, I come from God. And so before anything else, I view myself as a child and a servant of God. And as my brother Richard said, this work is really a form of ministry for me. And it started for me at the tender age of 15 when I became a father myself. And so it was really in that moment where I was forced to grapple with what it meant to be not just a father, but a black father here in Chicago. And as I was coming of age, I oftentimes had not so good experiences with various public systems and institutions that was supposedly family serving institutions. However, anytime I would go to those institutions in need of support or assistance, a not so subtle message was communicated to me that my presence was not wanted. And instead of embracing me as an asset to the family, I was oftentimes viewed as a liability. And that really sparked within me this deep desire to want to change things for the better, not just for myself, but just thinking about the community of men that I represented. And so I eventually went off to school, and one of my first jobs out of undergrad was at Family Focus Lawndale. And I think we got some family-focused people in the crowd. I see my brother Darren back there. But I served as a co-facilitator for a fatherhood support group called Mission Men. And so we were doing a lot of work in the North Lawndale community in partnership with the Safer Foundation. As many of you all know, they have their adult transition center in North Lawndale. And so Family Focus was providing a lot of direct supportive services to those men in the community. And one of the things that always stood out to me after each cohort of fathers came through our program is that it really isn't a discussion about personal responsibility. That could be a part of the discussion, but this was also a conversation about having responsible policies on the books that will affirm the humanity and the dignity of so many of the men who were coming through our doors. Once I had that realization, I decided that I wanted to pursue my PhD so I can equip myself with the empirical knowledge and insights to better advocate for my community. That led me to spending some time at Georgia State University in Atlanta, while I also found myself in the community working with brothers throughout Metro Atlanta who had the same issues. Fast forward, spent a couple of years at Duke. During the time of the pandemic and the racial reckoning, and yet again, I found myself in the community throughout Durham and the same issues that I saw black men trying to overcome in Atlanta and in Chicago were also prevalent within those communities. And so coupled with the events that had transpired with the pandemic, the racial reckoning, and me also dealing with a great deal of personal loss at that time, over a 10-month period, I lost 8 of my childhood friends, 6 due to gun violence, 2 due to fatal car crashes, nevertheless, all premature deaths. And so it just forced me to reflect more deeply about what it is I was doing, and it forced me to really appreciate the fragility of life. And so for me, it was like, well, we all got to go home one day. And so for me, it was an opportunity to return home and engage in this work. And so that's how I found myself here at Fathers, Families, and Healthy Communities. And before I turn the floor over to you, I do also want to acknowledge that Fathers, Families, and Healthy Communities also has its own set of founding fathers. Saquon Lawrence, Dr. Michael Bennett, Dr. Kirk Harris, who is not here with us today. But these men really laid the foundation for the organization that I'm now running. And it would be a great disservice to you all for you all not to know who those men are and the work that they did to establish this. Thank you.
I want to stick with you, Dr. Boyd, for a second. And I want you to just, at a high level, were there any findings from the research that were surprising to you? I want to mm-hmm. highlight anything you think that was unexpected. And then I want to tee up Richard, because I want to come behind you and have Richard talk more about guaranteed income as a key solution. But yeah. First, the research.
Yeah, so Well, I'll go back to something that you said in your opening remarks. As we were conducting this research and we had an opportunity to start analyzing the findings, unfortunately for me as somebody who's a trained scholar who does work in the fatherhood space, we really didn't learn anything that had not already been unearthed through previous studies. Oh. In fact, as I was reviewing the findings, I couldn't help but reflect on W.E.B. Du Bois's groundbreaking study, The Philadelphia Negro, which he published in 1899, that basically highlighted the same issues that we're grappling with today in 2025. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's not that the findings were surprising. What I think tends to happen is we overlook what black men and black fathers are telling us because we don't always value what it is that we bring to the conversation, especially when we're trying to advocate for ourselves. And one of those findings is really connected to what we coined in the report, the hidden cost of economic marginalization. Oftentimes, we think about a man's inability to provide for himself and his children financially as just being connected to financial strain, when in essence it has a reverberating effect because it takes a deep psychological and emotional toll on those men who may be unable to provide for their children in ways that are personally meaningful to them. They may be in partnership, and their partner may have a certain expectation that they're going to contribute financially to the household or to other needs that the child may have. But when the father is unable to do so, it creates within them this deep sense of shame and spiritual anguish that can lead to various forms of withdrawal. Some of it is emotional, and then sometimes, unfortunately, you'll have a father who may distance himself completely from his family because the pain of not being able to provide in a way that is personally meaningful for him is so heavy to carry that he feels as if he's doing his family a service by removing himself mm-hmm. from the family unit. Mm-hmm. And so, again, you just think about that being the story of an individual father. What if you have communities that have men within them that are living through this day-to-day reality where they're not where they would like to be from a financial standpoint, and it just creates a sense of anguish that, again, extends beyond what the individual father is encountering, but it has a reverberating effect across families and communities.
Gotcha. I want to thank you, Dr. Boyd. I want to pivot, Richard, to you, and we're going to spend some time talking about the recommendations.
Yeah.
And one is the need to advance guaranteed income
yeah.
type programs. I would love to hear you speak to that recommendation.
Yeah.
And then tee up Dion to talk about how that was such recommendations would impact your life had you had access to them.
Yeah. Yeah, so again, Richard Wallace, founder of Equity and Transformation, also known as EAT, and we have four main pillars of work. One of them is we build alternatives to meet the immediate needs of our community. With that being said, we launched a guaranteed income program called the Chicago Future Fund, which was a guaranteed income pilot project. The first in the nation happened here in Chicago, right? The first in the nation to serve specifically formerly incarcerated people. And people will ask, why formerly incarcerated people? I think when we think about the nature of, the history of black folks in the United States, it's been a war for labor. It's been a fight for access or equal access or a living wage exchange for our labor. Right, which starts with, of course, the Three-Fifths Clause and slavery, but it advanced through different iterations. It looked like black codes, Jim Crow laws, and then ultimately the system of mass incarceration. So the mark of criminal of mass incarceration, what that does is that me, as somebody who's also, and let me also say that this brilliant research was done by formerly incarcerated people. Right? a qualitative, quantitative, you know what I'm saying? Research initiative led by and designed by formerly incarcerated people, and I think that's important. We have to invest, right? Not just in the cream of the crop, but in the margins. Particularly when you live in a city like Chicago, where the New School just released a report that our wealth is zero.
Right.
The net worth of black families is zero. So regardless if everybody in this room got a check, does your cousin got a check? Does your auntie got a check? Does your nephew and your niece has got a check? Because if not, it all balances out to zero. Right? And so we have to invest. It's like, so we can't get past that zero mark unless everybody rises up. Right? And so that, for me, meant that we had to create an intervention specifically for formerly incarcerated people. And I think a lot of the history around that comes from the pandemic. If y'all remember the CARES Act, right? Everybody got that first check. Who got that check? That first $500 check when the pandemic kicked off? They called them STEMI. No, was it STEMI? Yeah, STEMIs. But there was a caveat in the STEMIs that essentially said that if you hadn't worked in the last 5 years, right, or if you owed child support, you were ineligible, right, to receive that check. In our mind, people who hadn't worked in the last 5 years and didn't have the money to take care of their babies needed it the most. And so we launched a guaranteed, it wasn't called guaranteed income at that time because I didn't have the language. We was just handing out checks, right? It was a direct financial assistance program off Madison and Pulaski, and we also went out south. Because we knew that we were battling multiple things, the ghost of Tuskegee, right? Because a lot of our folks were still on the ground in the streets like the pandemic was not happening. And we were out there trying to educate people on the pandemic from trusted sources, other people who've been through what they've been through. And we were learning that folks were like, well, I'm out here making money. What does it mean to work from home if you actually have to hit the streets to make ends meet? Right? And so we began to do direct financial assistance and create pods and all of those things. And then we learned during that process about guaranteed income. And I went to my desk and I started researching the guaranteed income initiatives all around the world. And what it looked like was like, this is great, but I'm a big fan of John Powell's work around targeted universalism. He has a framework where he talks about focusing in on targeted populations and advancing, you know, towards equity through investing in the folks who are furthest removed from safety. And I feel like what keeps most people safe is a 9-to-5 that pays a living wage. If everybody in this room lost their jobs, how safe would you be? You understand what I'm saying? And then you have a whole entire segment of our society that is excluded from participation in the only avenue we have in order to acquire subsistence, right? In order to acquire the things, food, water, and shelter, right? In order to do that, and this is our system under capitalism. We have to sell our labor to someone else. They give us a wage. We use that wage to buy the things we need to survive. It is not a barter and trade society. It's not an agrarian. We live in under this system. And that yet there are thousands and thousands of people who are denied access to that vital tool of labor because of their background. And so what is essential for us, if we're going to have an experiment around guaranteed income, we're going to focus on the margins. We're going to focus on folks who don't have access to economy. And through that pilot, we're able to win a lot of people to this idea around guaranteed income. But at the end of the day, we're able to invest in new leaders, right, who can lead this guaranteed income movement. We're able to change the narrative as it related to, like, who needs investment. Out of 100 participants that participated in the Chicago Future Fund, only 3 had any engagement with law enforcement after an entire year, which is, it throws recidivism rates on its back. Right, there were increases in psychological wellness, increases in physical functioning, all of the things we kind of knew would happen, but we got to prove it, right? And yet they don't have to prove things like prisons work, right? But we have to prove that things like guaranteed income work. Like, if you have income in your pocket, you probably won't steal this, right? Common sense says you'll pay for it if you got the money, right? And so for us, that's the work of Equity and Transformation, the Chicago Future Fund. I also want to shout out to our team, because I would not be here. This report wouldn't have been possible without the brilliant leadership of Rachel Peon, our research director at Equity and Transformation. Alonzo Waheed, our program director, Glenn Taylor, our field director. We have an entire team of leaders, Maurice, so on and so forth. I don't want to miss nobody. If they ask, I said everybody's name. And so we are a team of folks that came together to make this happen. And the end result is seeing the light in Dion. People are like, why you do it? Because ever since we did this pilot, Deion then spoke at City Hall. Mm-hmm. He's traveling to Springfield. He is the champion. So oftentimes we think about, he is a champion. So I think about when the greatest advocates for, I think, our visions around black men in labor are going to be those people that actually experience the intervention, right? And so I'm really excited to have Deion be here, and I'm going to pass the mic to Deion to do his thing. So that's it.
Okay. How y'all doing again? I basically want to start out by saying it's been a wonderful experience for me because they actually count guys like me out. You know, as he was saying, like, they exclude us from so many different things and through so many different avenues of exclusion, you know, due to our criminal background or, you know, mistakes we may have made when we was younger. You know, they try to treat us as second-class citizens. But it's actually guys that's very intelligent, you know, that learn from their mistakes. First of all, I just want to put that energy out there because I speak for those people, you know, the people that, you know, they give a chance to, that we actually are intelligent, you know, we actually are well-versed, we actually love our families and our children, you know, actually just want the opportunity to do better, you know, and through Equity and Transformation and the Guaranteed Income Program, it just opened my world up to so many different avenues that, you know, that probably would have been presented to me. And that's most important because it broadened my horizons, you know. Even just speaking as far as into the $500 that they gave me a month, that did something for me because I could be able to rest assured that I could buy my daughter some shoes, you know, or something like that. I could put my energy into a better space because now I'm not worried about frivolous things, that's small things in this big world, you know. And a lot of us just want a launching pad. It don't necessarily have to be monetary, you know. Health and wellness, you know, mental wellness, you know, building with people with like-minded ideas, you know, that's very important. You know, the money, that's just the starter, you know, that's just a tool to lead you in the right direction because we all need stability. And, you know, that's basically what that provides. When you have stability, you're at rest and, you know, you tend to have more positive outlooks on things. So that's basically the point I want to get across to y'all.
I want to, Dr. Boyd, I'm going to go to you to talk about your concept around wraparound services and how important they are to supporting men like Deion. But before you speak, I want to just flag this with Dan Gibbons. Well, after this answer, we'll go into Q&A. That's okay. All right.
Cool. Well, yeah, just echoing the sentiments of my brother Deion, oftentimes I feel as if the traditional approach to our workforce development programs is to assume that the men that are coming to them are completely broken, that they have no assets that they're bringing to the table, that they've actually honed out in the informal economy, or even if you think about whatever their involvement may have been in street life activities. However, when you think about what it really takes to exist in that world, you develop a complex set of skills that are transferable in nature. Yeah. And so for me, I think that needs to be the starting point for any type of workforce development program that we have for black men and black fathers. View those men as assets from the time they show up at the door, regardless of what their past mistakes may have been. As Brian Stevenson often talks about, we are more than the worst thing we've ever done. And it's really that spirit of redemption that should fuel the work that we do, especially if we're committed to uplifting people, especially if we're committed to uplifting black men in the context of this work. And so I would also argue that we should expand our definition. It shouldn't just be workforce development. It should be human development. We have to recognize that these are full people who are coming into these workforce programs. And so if you have an individual who may have a deep desire to show up, learn the skill, apply the new skill to a new job that he may have received, if he is encountering barriers that prevent him from showing up to receive the training, don't dismiss him. Think about ways in which you can bring additional supplemental supports and resources to the table that can provide that comprehensive wraparound support service structure that is required. What that looks like could be some mental health services for the men. It could look like some transportation assistance, child care assistance, actually having fatherhood programming at the site. Because what we've learned through our work at Fathers, Families, and Healthy Communities is that whenever you create an emotionally safe space for brothers to come together, they will take advantage of that opportunity and begin to build a community among themselves that will allow them to hold each other accountable. And also, there's a lot of positive information that's being shared in that group that will only aid that man or that father in accomplishing whatever his life goals or dreams may be. But we need to create an environment for that type of work to take place. And we need to invest the appropriate level of resources into that work. Because, again, the title of today's convening is the imperative of investing in Black men and Black fathers. And we need to make positive investments in Black men and Black fathers because, as my brother Richard said, we've made investments in Black men historically, but it's been in a punitive fashion. We want to reverse the tide and actually get folks to shift those resources further upstream so we can ensure that the talents, the skills, the positive attributes and characteristics that our brothers possess have an opportunity to be on full display for the world to marvel at. Thank you.
Wonderful.
I'm right here in the center of the room. I'm going to start over at the Loyola table and ask that everybody keep the question and answers quick so we can get hopefully one or two more in. And if you raise your hand, I'll try to get to you next. Please introduce yourself. Thanks.
Yeah, of course. Hello, I am Elijah Niang. I'm a sophomore at Loyola University of Chicago and a member of the Rambler Brotherhood Project. And my question is, with the abolishing of systems that are meant to counteract inequality, how can we make sure everyone has a fair chance, regardless of race and gender? How can we implement the policy recommendations listed in the current political climate?
Thank you. Richard?
And, you know, there was no policy to, you know, to build the Underground Railroad, and it was built.
Teach.
Right? I think our freedom is always going to be in the imagination of our minds.
Talk about it.
And so we need to invest in that, right? We need to invest in local organizations, because when the pandemic hit, it was local grassroots folks over on the ground that were providing direct financial assistance, that were providing mutual aid. When the city was shut down and it quarantined, there was people on the ground bringing fresh produce in to communities. That was not a policy. And so I think when we think about policy, we always think about the state in specific, but there's community policies that we can enforce, right? And so I think about, you know, even in this political environment, right, the agency, the creativity of our people is actually going to flourish.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to grow because we don't have any other option, and we've always figured it out. We've always made lemonade out of lemons. And so we know very clearly what our people need, and I think it's important for there to be investment in these grassroots organizations across the country that are filling the gap, really, at the end of the day. So that would be my answer to you.
Yeah. Just to quickly build on your answer, I would say we don't have a knowledge gap. We have a courage gap. And we really need to think about what does it mean for us as a community to band together as a community to create the type of conditions within our community that will allow our people to be free and liberated. And it's also important for us to center community wisdom, especially in the time that we're currently living in. And what I mean by that is there needs to be more conversation that occurs across generations, because we are all links in the same chain. And if we were to think about the current socio-political climate that we're operating in, we can leverage the lessons of history to help inform the strategies and the tactics that we develop today to overcome any obstacle that is in front of us. And I do believe that a lot of the work is going to have to take place within the community. And we are going to have to engage in courageous resistance in the moment that we currently find ourselves in, and we have to be willing to lose something. We may have to forfeit a seat at the table of comfortability right now, and we have to be okay with doing that, because no one person can rise above the condition of their people. And with that being said, we have to lean in to unity right now, because our disunity historically has been the weapon that the enemy has used against us.
We don't have time for another question, but we're going to do it anyway. Is that all right? Okay. Do you have a question here?
Hey, brothers.
How you doing?
It's good to be here, y'all. Xavier Ramey, founder and CEO of Justice Informed. This is definitely an inside the house question that we about to have outside the house. So I think part of the challenge of why black men are not being centered, why they're not believed, why more people are not curious about us, and why the statistics show about us what they have shown for over 100 years, is partly because in the modern time, we are at a crossroads as it relates to the question of where do black men sit and what is our value as fathers, as employees, and as people, given the challenges and the hurt in our own community as it relates to gender. When we talk about a black man being necessary in a black house, a question arises. What does that say about single black mothers? And the hurt and the pain, regardless of whether that man is not in that house because of the carceral state, regardless of whether it is because of personal challenges, regardless of whether, whatever the reason may be, there is still a hurt. But to validate that a black man has value in the house requires us to say that two things have value when they're separate and more value when they're together. Mm. That blackness has value when it has a house. Mm-hmm. And that men bring value that is distinct when they are in the house.
Sure.
And I don't think our society has decided on whether it's comfortable with saying that because of how it shines a light on the challenges that we face and how resilient our women are, but how broken our families are. And so I'm curious, because we got fathers up there, we got brothers up there. This is a very in-the-house question. But I'm asking, what are your thoughts about how we deal with this question of just even saying black men matter, black fathers matter, because of how it shines a light on other ways that our resiliency allows us to still survive, even if we don't thrive?
Good question.
You want to go?
I'll jump in. All right, so I'll say a little bit. Xavier, way to go. Good to see you. It's the last question. But, you know, I think, you know, I've been in this work for a while, right? And I agree, you know, there always is this either or when it comes to investment. And at the end of the day, it is a both and, right?
Right.
And so I don't... y'all can clap. This is not the case statement for either or. This is the case statement for both and, right? And that our communities are, when you think about the per capita income in like West Garfield Park, it's $18,000. That's everybody, right? You think about the zero net worth of black families. That's everybody. And this report is a unique look, a behind-the-scenes look at what is the experience of black men, right? And so I think that is as it relates to this story and how we're trying to talk about it, it is not an either-or. This is just the case for black men. And so I want to shout out, you know, like folks like Avalon, who are doing amazing work. I want to shout out folks like Barbara Ransby, who has done amazing work, right? I want to shout out, you know, there's tons of work and information out there. This is just another piece to that puzzle. And so I want y'all to take it as such, right? Not take it as, are we just going to focus on? And look, it's part of it, right? And so that's the piece that I would add. Go ahead.
Yeah.
The one point I want to underscore is the point I made earlier about the importance of healing, creating space for our community to come together and do the necessary work, individual work and collective work, family work around healing. When I joined the Field Foundation, I spent for the better part of a year just in the community listening. And what I heard when I was listening from black mothers, black women raising kids, they were saying, well, what about...
Exactly.
You know, they were asking me, telling me that we need to invest in the men in our community, the young boys in our community. We need to scale up, not just when in the context of street violence. We need to do that. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, we need to move, as Dr. Boyd said, upstream and invest in young boys, teenage boys, adult men in our community. And those investments have to be paired with the necessary work around healing.
Yeah.
And the community is asking for that. They're demanding that, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
Where's Dan?
And we can't wait to talk about it some more. This was incredible. I know there are a whole host of questions out there. We had so many more pre-submitted. We're going to have another discussion, right? Daniel, you okay with that?
Yeah.
Okay. Real quick, thank you also ERS Enterprises. I missed you earlier, and the Archdiocese of Chicago for also Sawyers, and then also the Archdiocese of Chicago for sponsoring, which does remind me that I think we should take a moment to thank an incredible father figure, right, with Pope Francis, who we lost yesterday. And the true Jesuit tradition was truly a man for others and a father figure, really, to the whole world. Thank you to the Pope. Thank you for his dedication, his entire life to the family. I know we all have plenty of mourning and ways to celebrate his life, but of course we at City Club and here in Chicago care a great deal about that and appreciate all that he's done. To all of you, Dion, Richard, Dr. Boyd, especially you, Daniel, thank you. That was incredibly insightful. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We will do this again. We will have further conversations, and hopefully every time we come back, things are better and better and better. We're committed to that here at City Club and welcome you all back anytime. Appreciate everybody's attendance and a few extra minutes today, and hope to see you all soon. We've got the Park District Superintendent tomorrow, Carlos Ramirez Rosa, and then I have another program on May 7th that is escaping me at the moment. But we have a number of things coming up, and we hope that you all, if you're not members, sign up. Keep coming. This is your club. Keep bringing us ideas like Daniel and his team has, because these are the conversations we need to have. So thank you so much. Welcome back to City Club anytime. Thanks to our panelists. Thank you to the Field Foundation. Have a great day.